from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, The Mysteries of the Teenage Brain. My guest will be author, neuroscientist, and single mother of two, Frances Jensen, and we'll talk to her about the latest research on the adolescent brain, and she'll offer tips for parents who feel like another species has suddenly entered their household.
How could this person be that same chubby little cherubic child that you took care of up until puberty? You have to realize that they, in part, can't help it.
That's next on Forum after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Neuroscientist Frances Jensen says that when her two sons became teenagers, she marveled at their ability to stay focused for a test, yet still commit major lapses in judgment almost daily. The contradictions, she explains, are driven in part by biology. Brains do not fully develop until people are in their mid to late 20s, and the very last part of the brain to mature is the frontal lobe, which controls decision-making, impulsiveness, and risk-taking. Frances Jensen, who is professor and chair of the Department of Neurology at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine, joins us this hour to talk about what makes the teen brain tick and about her new book, The Teenage Brain, A Neuroscientist's Survival Guide to Raising Adolescents and Young Adults. And welcome to Forum, Frances Jensen.
Thank you.
Good to have you with us. Let's begin by just talking about, different teens, you get different behaviors and so forth. But what comes through with a lot of this research and what you focus on is the unpredictability, your own sons being a little bit subjects of judgment and research. I like the fact that you bring in your own life here, and congratulations on that. But it's just that when kids do misjudge sometimes, or when they act out of lack of realizing consequences of a risky behavior, it may have to do more with the frontal lobes. It may have to do with those not being fully connected than it has to do with just kids being kids, or even things like peer influence.
That's right. And in fact, while their frontal lobes are less connected, they do have frontal lobes, by the way. There is something in there. It just hasn't been fully connected with fast acting connections yet. And the brain actually connects different regions together from the back of the brain to the front. So the last place to actually have these fast acting connections is the frontal lobe. But interestingly, while you point out the frontal lobe is the seat of our, executive, very adult-like functioning, such as impulse control, decision-making, judgment, empathy, there is another part of the brain which is very fully active in the adolescent brain, which is actually the limbic system, the area in your brain that actually sits sort of behind where your ears are, sort of in there. And that is the seat of risk, reward, impulsivity, sexual behavior, and emotion.
And reptilian behavior. So even, right?
No. Well, so they are built to be novelty seeking at this point in their life.
They're almost built that way, you're saying.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
But they're also better learners. People have realize that. I mean, they get memories more readily than adults do.
Yes. So this is the paradox of the adolescent brain and the young adult brain. They're actually – the individual regions of the brain aren't as fully connected as they will be later in life. And we've just talked about their limbic system being more connected at a time when their frontal lobe isn't as connected. So the frontal lobe isn't able to say, that's a bad idea. Don't do that. You should really think twice. They're not getting – that is not happening to the extent it will in adulthood. So off goes the risks, and they take a lot of novelty at that point. But interestingly, while that is a relative weakness of the adolescent brain, there are strengths of the adolescent brain. Each brain region that we talk about is actually more active in childhood and adolescence than it will be later in life. We have 100 billion brain cells called neurons in our brains, and they make about 100 trillion connections at little points called synapses. And you have more synapses in childhood and adolescence, and it sort of slowly prunes down to fewer synapses in adulthood. The activity at these synapses are what we use for learning. So hence, they really are faster learners. They can build synapses faster, just like children. Of course, it's even better in children. You know, children can learn 2 and 3 languages flawlessly, right? But adolescents still have a lot of that capacity.
But so here's the rub. They also learn the wrong things easier.
Well, so this is the point. We sometimes think about this as like they're really like Ferraris with weak brakes. They are learning machines, but they can learn good and bad things. It turns out that learning behaviors and also, is also involved in addiction. So interestingly, this starts to explain why addiction, which is really just building synapses, unfortunately, in the addiction circuits of your brain, they can do better, sadly, than adults. So they can learn harder, stronger, longer, faster, but they can get addicted harder, longer, stronger, faster. So this is beginning to show us like the double-edged sword of this time period. There's unique strengths and vulnerabilities. And I think a better understanding of this and getting the science out there helps all the adults around these kids. Now, last I checked, you and I and most of the adults listening today have their frontal lobes in there and they are well connected. So sometimes I say to groups that I speak to that we adults need to give these teenagers a frontal lobe assist from time to time because to help them with decision making and making judgments about risk and reward.
Well, you say we need to be their frontal lobes until their brains are wired. And I want to get into that because that brings up some real questions about parenting. But let me just go through some of the facts that I think are really fascinating in all this. The brain is the last organ actually to mature. So the reality is some of you who are going through the throes of adolescence with your progeny may not have some of this over until, late 20s even?
So, yeah, I do quite a bit of work with colleges and universities, and it's important to point out that your brain is not done when you enter college, and it is definitely not done when you even finish college. And so when it really makes us think about behavior in colleges as well, and also the whole college decision-making process and how parents can help with their kids as you go through that at the end of high school.
Well, you know, the fact of parents being the frontal lobes for kids. I mean, you talk about your own kids and you talk about the necessity for really almost scaring them straight in some ways. I mean, you know, look at what happens to this kid who is drinking and driving and so forth. And all that has to be impressed upon them even to a greater degree. And I buy that. I think that's really the case. But then you find kids who rebel against being, you know, hectored and being essentially nagged as they see it. I had one of those, now a fine adult and so forth, but there was rebellion again. You know, I don't want to hear all these stories and they don't want to believe them. Their brains aren't wired to believe them. They're not insulated enough.
Yeah, I mean, that is the issue here. Of course, kids believe that they're immortal, they know best, all these things. That's actually a product of their current brain state, that they would believe that about themselves. They're at a point where they're trying to figure out their identity. It's an awkward time in life, if you will, and society is equally as awkward about it when you think of sort of the multiple kind of ambivalent messages we give, to this teen generation. They can drive, but not at night, but they can go and work, you know, be enrolled in the army. They can vote, but they can't drink, et cetera. It's just it's a really not clear message we're giving them either. And it speaks to the fact that there's so much variability at this point. I mean, we can look at average brain development and, you know, average tracks, but there are very many early boys, late girls, et cetera. So it's a mixed population.
Girls are better learners than boys, though, aren't they?
No, I don't think girls are better learners than boys. What we do
during adolescence?
Well, during adolescence, their brain development, when they hit that peak in synapses that I was just talking about, and when they and where they are with like building the fast connections, this process we call it myelination, where you're insulating the connections from one brain cell to the next, or one region of the brain to the next, so that it's electrical signals. So it's just like insulating the electrical wires with rubber, but we don't have rubber in our brains. We have something called myelin. Little tiny cells have to wrap these.
And aren't the frontal lobes the last to get that?
That's right. Little tiny cells have to wrap all these connections and they finally get to the frontal lobes in your mid to late 20s. That happens a couple of years early on average in girls. So, you know, this is an odd average. There are many early boys and late girls, but you think about a 15-year-old girl versus a 15-year-old boy. And I think, I don't need to explain anything more. Just image that.
I image endocrine systems that are very different in terms of testosterone and the like. And by the way, we're talking to Dr. Frances Jensen. She's professor and chair of the Department of Neurology at University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine and the author of The Teenage Brain, A Neuroscientist's Survival Guide to Raising Adolescents and Young Adults. She'll be at City Arts and Lectures tonight at 7:30 in San Francisco. And in the meantime, we'll certainly have an opportunity for you, our listeners, to talk with her and get advice from her. And emotions can affect kids more than adults, basically, is what you're saying, too. Yeah?
Yes. So this is something I think is really useful for parents and teachers and folks that are around adolescents and, frankly, the adolescents themselves. Why do they react like, you know, it's an international incident when something minor like, you know, somebody wears the same outfit to school the same day and your daughter or son comes home just melting down around what you consider is a completely innocuous event? When you look at their brains and their ability to handle emotional stress, they will activate at least two times as high. These are functional imaging studies have looked at children, adolescents, and adults given the same sort of emotional stressor. And the adolescent will light up the emotional areas, this limbic part of their brain, the limbic system, twice or even more as high as children or adults. So they are really uniquely experiencing some what you would consider an innocuous event as an international incident, about as much activity an international incident would get out of your brain if you were to experience one. So I think we need to remind ourselves they're experiencing emotion in technicolor while we're experiencing sort of black and white. And it begins to make you understand like why they behave the way they do. Maybe you can count to 10 and not like react. Use your frontal lobes. Back off and reapproach in a more organized way.
Well, you sort of intimated this before. Addiction for adolescents is faster, it's easier, and it can have, you know, long-term effects. So better to forearm and forewarn as best you can. And you've also spoken out on the dangers of binge drinking. Adults can drink a lot and they can feel sedated, whereas adolescents, you know, can be really affected and get their brain pickled, or as my dad used to say, you know, your brain gets poisoned by liquor. I don't know if I listened to him that much, but I certainly took it in. The fact is that when we're talking about adolescence, though, we're talking about behavior that is very, all the jokes notwithstanding, it's like they're aliens. They're strangers in a strange world from us, and we have to deal with them almost as if they're from another planet. And then you get the concerns about, you know, they're getting strung out on various kinds of substances because there are all those peer pressures to try them. So let's talk about, for example, the fact that some adolescents can be hooked on marijuana and, you know, really get almost brain dead or act as if they're that way, catatonic, semi-catatonic. And some can be using marijuana on a regular basis and seem to function fine, I mean, in terms of school and the rest of those kinds of things. And new research tells us what?
Yeah. So this is a very hot area, an emerging area of research. The story is not conclusively over yet. So what we do know is that marijuana, like most substances of abuse, function at synapses, right? That's how they're modulating whether your brain cell is going to turn itself on or off, because these connections between brain cells send a signal from one cell to the other saying, I'm going to turn you on or off in whatever network it's involved in, depending upon whatever task or whatever you're doing. So cannabis actually turns these brain cells off. It acts in a, it decreases your ability to build synapses for learning. Now, because you have more synapses as a teenager, there's more drug, there's more substrate for the drug to bind to. So number one, there it's hanging on in their brains to a greater extent for the same dose of this drug. And this is not unique to this drug, but it certainly has been documented for this drug. It might be around for 4 days in the brain.
And excuse me, is there more dopamine than kind of neurotransmitters wanting that too?
Well, yes. So it has an ability to impair learning and memory to a greater extent in the teenage and adolescent brain, both in animal studies and in humans. Now, that's on a single dose basis, right? But what is quite concerning is the literature that's starting to come out about chronic daily cannabis use. That is what we're really concerned about, because chronic exposure to the brain while it's growing and using its environment to sort of shape itself, if you have a chronic substance that's not a natural substance, you know, not supposed to be in your brain all the time, it's going to change the way your brain's going to turn out. And there are some concerning studies that have come out showing that your IQ will drop permanently if you are exposed to chronic daily cannabis through this adolescent window. And that's what we, you know, want to get that message out. I think, you know, better safe than sorry. That information is out there. It has been replicated a few times. It could probably be, there are studies ongoing to continue to replicate it. But I think what parents and teens themselves need to know, that despite the fact that, you know, marijuana is being legalized everywhere for recreational sort of sporadic use, chronic daily use in the developing brain is still a big open question. And there's research to suggest it's really not a good story.
It's also being legalized and somehow... We haven't heard a lot about how you can test young people who may be drawn to marijuana and who may be impaired when they're driving. This is a whole other can of worms that we've talked about before. But if there's a problem with impulse control where alcohol or marijuana are concerned, you have to wonder about parents who say, well, it's just a phase. You know, these kids are just going through a phase, because many parents do take that and almost use it as an excuse.
Right. I think that this is where, you know, a lot of this new research is debunking many myths. This idea is like, oh, they're resilient, they'll get over it, is actually quite wrong in terms of stressors, be emotional stressors in this window, or substances. They actually leave a lifelong change imprinted into the brain at that point to a greater extent than a fully adult brain. So you're actually affecting the brain during a period of growth. So you're going to affect the way the brain is growing. Interestingly, alcohol you mentioned, we know we take alcohol, you know, socially people drink alcohol to disinhibit themselves, right? So what's happening in the adolescent, they are actually more susceptible to the effects, the disinhibiting effects of alcohol, because first of all, your frontal lobe is the thing that is sending these inhibiting messages back to say, bad idea, don't do it. That's getting disinhibited by alcohol. So can you imagine the case in which there isn't much of a frontal lobe sending messages back and you disinhibit it with alcohol? This explains why they are more prone to those risky behaviors under the influence of alcohol. Not to mention, binge drinking has been shown to permanently affect those connections as they grow, so that several years later, there have been studies that test decision-making capacity for risk in people who are drinkers through adolescence versus not. And they're impaired as adults. So, you know, we do need to think about this window as a very precious window that you really need to mind your brain during this period, and it will mind you later. That's what I tell the adolescents when I give them talks myself.
Well, what do you say to the parents who say, well, I'm going to be able to monitor my kid because I smoke weed with my kid, or I drink with my kid, or I keep my adolescent children home, keep them from driving out there, and it's better that they drink at home. And, you know, if they drink to excess, well, you know, so be it, but they're not out there driving.
Well, you know, that they're not out there driving obviously is a much better choice than sending them out to drive under the influence. But I think we do have to be careful and just think about these studies. They are coming, you know, more and more studies are being done. This is like an exponential area of now new research, now that it has been realized that the adolescent brain is a specific brain stage as opposed to childhood and adult. And I think parents should make it their business to stay on top of what this research is showing. And I know in my book, I put a number of different studies that they can use. Again, I put facts in my book because if you're going to talk to a teenager, they are so not going to do what you say just because you tell them to do it. And if you have a few facts in hand and can say, well, there's a study that showed this or that, it can help make you somewhat more credible. But it also is important for the parents to do, you know, if whatever rules they're setting in their houses, I would just say they should be informed. And there's a lot of research out there that can help inform them.
A key phrase I took from your book is adolescents are too unaware of when to gate themselves. So I guess parents have to be not only frontal lobes, but gatekeepers and gate watchers and so forth. What about teen moodiness, though? I mean, are there neuroscience links? Some kids are just outright terribly moody. You hear parents complaining about this all the time. And some kids are, you know, fairly good mood all the time.
Sure. So that moodiness, this is, you know, emotional lability, we call it, sort of fluctuations of emotion. And I think I've just explained to you that this emotional part of your brain is actually very active in this window, more active than it will be later in life. And they have this, they're more reactive, you know, overreactive, if you will, to different emotional good and bad stimuli. So that explains why they're going to fluctuate much more over the course of a day or a week than everybody else in the family around things. So
forgive me, Dr. Jensen, there may be different set points in adolescence like there are in adults?
Well, interestingly, their ability to calm themselves down is not what it will be in adulthood. There's an interesting set of studies that have come out in the last few years about, this is a long word, tetrahydropregnenolone, in short, THP, which is a hormone, a neurotransmitter, a signaling molecule that comes out in your brain when you're stressed. And for adults, it will actually calm you down so that you kind of get to the work of managing your stress. I mean, I don't know if you've ever been in that, in a case where you've had something terrible happen and you're kind of shaky and frozen, and then suddenly you have this sense of calm to come and you like get to the work helping others around you or whatever. Teenagers don't have THP have that effect on their brains. Unfortunately, THP, which makes adults calmer, because of the brain state in adolescence, THP actually continues to actually increase the excitement. It does the absolute opposite in the teenage brain. So this calls like a feed-forward kind of more frenetic behavior under a risky situation or emotionally charged situation. And that's really amazing information, actually, that they don't have that kill switch that we have. In fact, it does quite the opposite.
And just in a practical way, you say teens can't necessarily multitask as much as they think they can.
That's right. Well, because multitasking does actually include some judgment and decision making as to actually how you're going to organize your tasks. So they are actually excellent at, you know, running like five devices simultaneously while attempting, you know, to walk or other they try to do other things, including drive when they're in that. And I think they have to realize that while they are really good learners and they it looks like they're actually learning the device, you know, managing the device very well, they're not necessarily going to be at their best. There's studies to show that while they are better at texting, et cetera, and faster than we are because it's a learned behavior and they're doing it during this, you know, very plastic period of their brain, they've grown up doing it. They still, if you're going to ask a teenager to learn something to its best or practice something and learn it in the most efficient way, they have to be full focused attention. Distracted attention, even in them, and there are studies that have shown this now, drops their ability to get good scores on whatever task they're being asked. So they have to recognize that there's a limit to this multitasking.
Well, we're coming up on a break, but I have to ask you, and I don't know necessarily what the research shows on this. I've always had suspicions that from things I've read, but things I've observed, that maybe there are neural pathways that are changing with all this use of devices, and what kind of extent does that? And what about the access to porn and all this? What's it doing to the teenage brain? Yeah. We really don't know. We're in pretty dark territory here, aren't we?
We are. There's no specific studies that actually are out to tell us what those environmental influences are doing at this point in time. But you've just hit upon a really important topic, though, which is plasticity. Remember I said we have synapses that are, growing. Like if you're learning a golf swing, you're activating a bunch of synapses. It's like a relay race in your brain, and all of them are getting strengthened. So you can shape your skill sets by building synapses, and you can do it best in childhood and adults. So we have to know that they can build parts of their brain and make themselves different for life based on what they're practicing as adolescents.
Well, lots of advice there and more to come, perhaps, and may indeed some of you want advice. It's a good place to come for it. Or if you have a narrative you want to share about the teenage brain, we welcome your involvement in this program. Our toll-free number is available, and that number to call is 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls, questions, or comments. Again, join us at 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Again, our guest is Dr. Frances Jensen. Her book is The Teenage Brain. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Frances Jensen. She's professor and chair of the Department of Neurology at University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. You were at Harvard before this. How long were you there?
Oh, almost 30 years.
Why the switch?
I came down to Penn to be chair of the Department of Neurology, and it's an awesome, awesome opportunity.
Awesome opportunity. Now you sound like a teen using that word awesome. By the way, we're
trying to stay current.
Take your calls and your emails, and do invite you to join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or you can email us, forum@kqed.org. We're talking about the teenage brain, which is, well, as Dr. Jensen says, a work in progress, and one hopes that the progress can move forward in ways that enhance it and that add to it, certainly. But it's difficult because it's different. We're talking about not only difference in brain, but difference in wiring, so to speak, in neuroscience, but differences in circadian rhythm. And that's why, among many other pieces of advice, she says, not a good idea to have your kid with a cell phone at night. In fact, here's Greg who says, I understand the physiological aspect of brain development, but can you venture an opinion about the effect that current culture has on you, things like families with both parents working and the advent of social media?
Oh, that is a great topic. And it is one of significant concern, I think, something we need as a culture and society to talk more about. So, okay, so the teenage brain, we've been talking a little bit about this, this building of the brain hasn't changed in, you know, eons. But what's happened is the environment around our teenagers has changed. So whereas teenagers were living in much more limited environments in prior, you know, centuries, you know, in the rest of the history of humanity, right now they're being bombarded by probably an unprecedented amount of information. They are information data-driven animal, you know, machines, these teenagers.
Forgive me, not probably.
Yeah, yes, they are. Yeah. And they're, you know, novelty-seeking. So where else are they going to get novelty? It's all over the internet. And what are we, you know, what is the conversation we should be having about the inappropriate, probably age-inappropriate stimuli they might find on the, you mentioned porn, for instance. And you know, other things that we can find on the internet that might cause stress through social and also social media, the effects of how does it kind of feed in and feed forward like frenzied peer pressure behavior, right? This gets discussed, and especially in college campuses, in fraternity behavior, this actually also gets discussed and fueled by alcohol or other substances that disinhibit them. It's really a whole new day, and they are playing with fire. Schoolyard pranks of yesteryear are not the same anymore.
The bullying has gotten so out of hand. Right. I mean, we've done programs on that, of course, but just the imagery that you can access online now, and some of it is so grotesque and so overwhelmingly grotesque.
And it's going to leave a mark. They're going to that you remember. By the way, there's neuroscience to show that your memories are better for stressful experiences. I think we all know this. You remember a stressful or bad thing like minute, second by second, whereas, you know, the rest of the days around it, you have no recollection, but you'll remember that stressful event. So unfortunately, they have a built-in way. They are better learners. So those stressful things will stay in their brains longer. And that is, you know, it's a concern. It's a conversation we have to have with them about how do you gate yourself with social media? How do we remind them to sort of go through some checklist? They are good learners. What is it that we can do? Can we do trial and error around, you know, there's almost no ability for them to have any error in their lives, given so much of their lives are actually kind of documented on Facebook and other places where they have to be very careful. But they need to rehearse. You know, life is about trial and error, and there needs to be an opportunity for them to rehearse mistakes and potentially mistakes in the social media domain before they actually do them themselves.
Well, here we get right to the heart of it. I want to go to your calls. There are many people who want to join us by phone, but a comment put on our online by Dave, who says, how do we square the late development of the frontal lobe with books such as Julie Lithcott Haim's book, Raising an Adult, which decries the helicopter parents who are trying to be the frontal lobe for their college-age children? It seems that there's a tension between enabling them to make their own decisions as opposed to supporting their still-developing skills from afar.
Hey, that's correct. That's why your frontal lobes can do that. There's a way to guide your child to make decisions independently rather than helicoptering over them. By absolutely no means am I suggesting being a helicopter parent. That is really bad because they will have no trial and error. They will have no mistakes to learn from. They'll have no personal experience. I think there's a new term, bulldozer parent, which I've heard, and that's even worse. We have to become more enlightened as parents and teachers around students and provide venues for them to make mistakes without it having to mar their academic record for life or what, you know, even legal record for life. How do we do that? This is we can bring this neuroscience to bear on this.
Let me bring some of our callers to bear. We begin with Lori. Lori, you're on the air.
Hi. So as a young person who is actually in recovery from drug addiction, I really appreciate hearing this conversation about maybe some insight into why my addiction came about, and also some sort of things to clap back at sort of older alcoholics and drug addicts who like to tell me they've spilt more beer than I've ever drank. But I have a question regarding, like, whether or not getting sober younger can help reverse some of the damage caused by chronic drug abuse.
Oh, well, first of all, congratulations on, you know, working your way out of addiction. That is an extraordinary feat. And I commend you as to where you are right now and wish you all the best for your future. So you're absolutely right. You got exposed to substances of abuse that caught hold much more quickly in your brain at the time you were a teenager or young adult than it would for the same amount of exposure in the adult. So you did have a higher hurdle to climb to get out of this. However, the good news is that you have this plasticity still in your brain all the way through this period of development. So you can, just as much as you can build bad synapses, bad connections, if you will, call them bad, you know, we'll just call them to be a little oversimplified bad connections, you can also counteract and build good connections in this window. In fact, rehab centers, which sadly, as you probably know, are, you know, the population in a lot of rehabs, drug rehab centers is shifting from, say, 15 years ago, where it was a bunch of, you know, older executives who are on alcohol, you know, addicted to alcohol and coming in to dry out. Now it's there. Many are filled with young people sort of between 16 and mid 20s, 25, 26 for this reason. But you are more resilient right now and you can actually build your way out of this. And in fact, we speak to the resiliency and that is the huge message into find and pick up this substance abuse as early as you can when it's happened, if it's happened.
Before your brain gets pickled.
Because you can turn it around if you get to it early. And that's really important. So I think it sounds like you're on a great new trajectory for yourself and keep going.
And thank you, Lori, for calling in. I appreciate hearing from you. And we're going to hear from another caller, and that's Dan. Dan, you're on.
Yes, hello. I was hoping if you could shed light on the old question of did Romeo love Juliet? So Juliet, as we all know, is, what, 13? Romeo, we don't know. He's maybe 15 or 16. He jumps from loving supposedly one girl to then seeing Juliet and being all hot and bothered for her.
Fair Rosaline was his love before Juliet, just for the record.
Thank you very
As a
much.
Former Shakespearean scholar, yeah.
That's what he says. But yeah, I mean, my feeling, maybe men's maybe different than women, is that initial infatuation and the long-term commitment are not, they're not necessarily different. So I was wondering what your research can shed on in terms of the 15, 16-year-old boys and girls and what emotions they feel. And I'm not just talking about the lack of being able to control their emotions, but that actual feeling, how real is it? It certainly was real to me when I was that age.
Absolutely. So, they have supercharged limbic systems, if you will. So your emotional areas, the sexual sexual incentive areas of your brain are actually on when your frontal lobes are not really able to send back a message saying, well, this might not be the right person for you, or there could be downstream consequences of this person. You know, there could be other consequences of this relationship. You're not going to have that at this age. But the feeling at that moment is feels very real to the person. It's bona fide, you know, emotion. It's just not emotion that's measured like it will be later in life that allow you to maybe say, I'm very attracted to this person, but there's a lot of reasons why this may not be. And that ends up sort of tempering your emotion and it fades away. It's not going to happen as rapidly in the teen brain. And you're right. It's a real emotion they're feeling. It's kind of unbridled.
And thank you, Dan, for that question. Good to hear from you. Let's hear from some more of our listeners. Let's go next to David. David, welcome. You're on the air.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for this show. I really appreciate hearing about the Dr. Jensen's research. And frankly, I wanted to ask some make a comment and then hear your opinion. And the comment is this research on the adolescent brain is all relatively new and still developing. And I appreciate that we're trying to help parents make decisions or facilitate decision making for their children. But I wanted to ask about implications for environmental and policy changes. And specifically, I think of how institutions like fraternities or institutions like the criminal justice system, where the premise was these were young adults who were making adult decisions in living situations or committing crimes. But now that we understand better, maybe some of these impulse decision making, how should that maybe shape some of our policies and environmental decisions?
Oh, yeah. So this does come up, as you can imagine, in the criminal justice system. And I've been on an author of two, with many other people, two amicus briefs to the Supreme Court. Actually, we were about this issue around what had been the law of the land, which was mandatory life without parole for, you know, major crimes like murder in people that were under 18. So they'd just be locked up for life. And we started out a few years ago with one. It was Jackson, was the case, name of the case. And this was for moving, assessing whether somebody who was 18 should be locked up for life without parole, just a mandatory. And we were able to show the neurobiology to the Supreme Court of the United States, and they actually overturned that and said, this will be done on an individual basis. A person will be evaluated by psychologists to determine whether there's resiliency or not. Because, of course, you're right. You could be making these decisions under the influence of an older peer, for instance, and you don't have the capacity to make the decisions yourself, and you're a risk-taking person. And but at the same time, you're young enough to be potentially rehabilitated. So we brought this to the court, and they actually did overturn that law. And now, a year ago, there was a second one that second amicus brief that led to looking back retrospectively at people who might be, say, 40 years old in jail since 18 or 16 or, you know, 14. Should they be released or, you know, sent to another facility for some rehabilitation? So, yeah, this is real. And I think it is getting listened to. And it's an important area of research to watch. Everybody thinks that neuroscience is going to be able to, like, you know, give you scans to tell if you're a lie detector, or, you know, if you're as lie detection or something. Neuroscience is so not there yet. But we can't tell you when somebody's, you know, whether you're an immature adult or a mature adult based on scanning yet. So I think we made that very clear, too, that you can't use neuroscience imaging to sort of call somebody a criminal versus not at this point in time.
And a reminder, we're talking to Dr. Frances Jensen. She's the author of The Teenage Brain, A Neuroscientist's Survival Guide to Raising Adolescents and Young Adults, and is professor and chair of the Department of Neurology, University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. And let me go to, before I go to more calls, and by the way, you can join us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. Let me go to some questions that are coming to us by email. Kay writes, I have a soon-to-be 10-year-old. Does he still have a child brain, or is it transitioning into a teen brain? Is there a way to identify when the brain patterns change, and what are good ways to support and educate them as they change?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, you know, again, we don't have, short of everybody on the planet getting a functional MRI, magnetic resonance imaging scan, to see how connected your brain is, which is unlikely. We can't really tell you where you know, on an individual basis, where somebody is. As I said,
they mature at different rates. Yeah.
Yes, individually and also as a group, girls versus boys, it's all just averages, right? But we know that it proceeds in one direction, which is good. And I think that many people, as they 10 years old is really sort of a time that's kind of at a cross window from this early childhood, incredible critical period plasticity, we call it. You know, plasticity being that your brain can mold itself to the environment and you create synapses for things that you become really good at. And, you know, you can develop major skill sets, including language acquisition. This is 10 is right in the middle of that still. And, you know, there's nothing. When puberty happens, it doesn't actually even tell us exactly where your brain stage is. There are no studies to say that when somebody begins to show some changes of sexual maturation that start puberty physically, it doesn't guarantee that, oh, now we know that the brain, the prefrontal cortex, is 20% hooked up. That is not it's not a one-to-one correlation with the outside of your body and inside your brain. So again, you'll see your child change, and you'll see them become, you know, go through this period. And there's so many amazing things about this period, and that, you know, you can actually continue to change your IQ in adolescence. And that's something I forgot to say earlier. That is a huge asset of the new, you know, what this new research is telling us. It's not just all about childhood, that you can actually modify, work on the strengths and try to correct the weaknesses of somebody well beyond the age of puberty.
Have any sage advice for parents who are wondering what their kid's going to do over the summer break? In terms of activity or perhaps enhancing that plasticity of the brain you keep alluding to?
Yeah, so that's exactly what I would suggest, is like, be mindful of this very cool neuroscience that says you can really work on strengths and weaknesses, build a skill or a sports skill or some other talent that your child has, the summer is an incredible time to do that. But also do some remediating work if there is a problem in school that you know is going to be an issue when they return. This is a great time to catch up. And remember, they're going to catch up 2 to 3 times faster than you would if you were given the same task, sort of for high school subjects. The other thing is to provide a relaxing environment and de-stress their lives because, you know, they perceive a lot of stress. We hear a lot about stress and anxiety in adolescence. And to be mindful of that, to give them a break from what they're perceiving as stress. And finally, sleep. They need their sleep. You know, their circadian rhythm is different from ours. They are set to go to sleep 2 hours later than we are approximately, if not longer. And that results in us waking them up at like 6 a.m, which is sort of like waking an adult up at 3 a.m. Not great for the brain and has been shown not to be great for school performance. So use the summer for these sort of things that help consolidate their brain health.
More of your calls. Petra, you're on the air with us. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Great show. I was wondering about damage to the brain that is done in infancy and childhood, for example, with adopted children from orphanage that display reactive attachment disorder. Is the teenage brain then able to overcome this? Is there a chance for these kids to completely be turned around by the plasticity of their brain at that stage?
That's a very good question. So I guess if you think of the earlier you have a damage to the brain, in some ways, the more, you know, profound it can be. So it becomes harder and harder to reverse, you know, the early life brain damage, you know, it has can leave lifelong marks. We know this. But at the same time, in early life, it's the best time to sort of try to correct that early in childhood, because that's your best chance of resiliency. Then as you go through into the adolescent, there's still this window and it still goes on. But we need to be doing it at both windows. You can't, ideally you want the rehabilitation to be present as early as possible and stay as long as possible. And what we're trying to say is that the brain is still developing all the way into your mid to late 20s. So there's a window, very prolonged window, for helping with these, you know, early life injuries.
Let me thank you for the call, Petra. Let me go to a comment from a listener and a question that's related to the comment. Trudy writes, I'm a child and adolescent psychiatrist, and I'm concerned that parents will write off the emotional liability of teenagers. No, I think she means liability, as just normal development. It can be often part of depression or bipolar disorder. If a teen also has other depressive symptoms, sleep or appetite disturbance, social withdrawal, irritability and anger, dropping grades, they should be evaluated for a mood disorder. And Mario asks specifically, when should parents consider medication to deal with depression versus just letting the teen deal with the ups and downs with this period in life?
I really appreciate this listener's comments, and we didn't have time to get to that in the earlier part of this program. But so as we point out, you know, they're going to be more emotionally labile. However, we need to be mindful that this is the time.
It's labile.
Yeah, labile. So this is the time for the onset of mental illness. So it turns out that onset of mental illness occurs in late teens, early adolescents. Schizophrenia, bipolar, depression, psychosis come on in this window with the highest frequency across the lifespan. This is when the symptoms start. And the reason for this is developmental. You need to have your prefrontal and frontal cortex, part of your brain, at least partially connected in order to have the manifestations of these diseases that you might already have, you know, as a genetic predisposition or due to some earlier life stressors. So this is when these illnesses come on developmentally. This is not because life is particularly mean or hard in this window, so people get depressed. This is a biological event, and we need to know that. We need to be aware that 1 in 4 people in our society have some form of mental illness, ranging from very mild, say, anxiety, mild anxiety, all the way to, you know, a major affective disorder to which your listener is speaking. And 60% to 80% of these people have the onset of their illness happen between the age of 16 to 18 and 26. That is a fact, and we need to know that this is a high intensity area. We know that suicidality is highest in males between like 21 to 23 years of age for probably this biological reason. And what we all need to have, and colleges are very good at this, and high schools are becoming better at it, parents need to become good at it, keeping your antennae up to determine, is this just a moody kid or is this actually mental illness? And I would say
sometimes
have a very low threshold.
Sometimes it's a very difficult decision to make, and you need professional, really, to
absolutely
help.
And you need to, as a parent, if you think your child is looking, not taking an interest in their appearance, losing their appetite, you know, really becoming more and more isolated, which I will grant you is much harder these days than it was 25 years ago, because all kids run up to their room, you know, run past the refrigerator, grab a drink, you know, food, and run to their room, slam the door, and stay in there all night. So you need to, you know, make sure you're part of your teen's life and probe what's going on. This is a really important fact, and something that we need to do a much better job of screening. And I've been talking to the HHS, which is Health and Human Services, about the possibility that we need to set up screening programs, better screening programs than what we have for mental illness in this window. Look, we do colonoscopy for 50-year-olds plus for colon cancer, which is at much lower rates, breast exams, prostate, you know, screening, but we need to do this.
You're listening to Forum. We're talking with Dr. Frances Jensen. Her book is The Teen Brain, and this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support this radio station, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And let me go to more of your calls. Let's go next to, is it my, Maeve, I'm sorry. Maeve, go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering about, you know, in addition to hopefully someday screening happening, what you would give parents in the way of advice to help children. Like my son is impulse driven. He has attention issues. Things can magnify very quickly. He had a traumatic event this year, and we want to help him learn how to navigate better. He's a pretty fixed mindset and really believes in his interpretation of things, and we just want to be able to help him have a little bit better steadiness when things get tough out there. So what kind of advice would you give to parents for different techniques or ideas or activities that might, you know, help a child in that kind of situation?
Yeah, so based on the facts that we know that they're going to be more, you know, stressed by, you know, things in their environment, and, you know, what we would call overreaction is just their reaction. And they may also be, you know, potentially more prone to mental illness that we've talked about there. So you need to sort of stay connected with your kid. I would say that, again, this idea of a frontal lobe assist, you know, review like the typical things that are happening. Is there cyberbullying going on? Is there, you know, something happening at school? And talk through it with your child. This is where you can really give them that assistance. You can say, you know, this is the logic. This is really not, as in, you know, it's not going to have the consequences that you are perceiving, or it's going to have these consequences you haven't thought of yet, and review and help them rehearse how they're going to manage that next encounter where you believe that they're very vulnerable, that, you know, to which you believe they're very vulnerable. I think there's a lot of opportunity there to help them have the words in them already as to what to say when somebody, you know, challenges them at school and might cause them to become anxious, you know, how to manage that. And again, it requires staying close to your kid. And that's what, not being a helicopter parent, but at least being in their lives to know what's going on. And that's why I'm hoping that, you know, rather than what parents often do when they have a kid that's, you know, kind of just looks difficult to deal with, they just say, oh, you're so frustrating. I'm pulling my hair out, quote unquote, you know, and then they begin to alienate them, because the last thing that kid needs is to hear you, you know, and it sounds like you're not, but, you know, there are parents that can kind of ridicule their kid, like, how could you be so silly to say this or that? This is not a time to mock them. This is a really important time where they're forming their identity.
Let me thank the caller. And a question, a couple questions from listeners. I hope we can get to more of your calls. But Cindy writes, what about the effects of Adderall, which is taken for ADHD, on the developing brain?
Yep. So that comes up a lot. So, you know, we just went through a, you know, a few minutes of me saying, well, you know, drugs are having effects on teenage brains and we have to be very careful. Well, guess what? Adderall is commonly treating ADHD or ADD. And the deal with that is that it is helping replace a natural substance called dopamine in the brain, which is required for focus and motivated learning. You know, we talk about dopamine being important for motivation. People with ADD and ADHD sort of are built with lower levels of this dopamine if they really have the diagnosis. And that's the point. You need to make sure that your kid has been screened by professionals professionals for and given a diagnosis based on screening, medical screening, not because a teacher says they're difficult in the class.
But there's some literature that suggests that kids who get that dopamine from, say, medication who are ADHD will become more likely to be, well, to go to drugs, to use
drug use. So it's a mixed group of people. So you want to be on the drug. You want, A, just the people that are really supposed to be on it, on the drug, and B, you want to only use it as, you know, for the number of years or months that it's necessary. And that's really important as they begin to grow their frontal lobes and decision making and can, you know, organize themselves better, which is part of the problem with
it. But do you think it can make them more vulnerable to
well,
high drug use?
Or, I think that these highly, you know, dopamine is an addicting substance,
yeah,
if you will, and it's part of the addiction circuit. So if it's given to people like who, you know, in college campuses, for instance, people tend to hand, those that are prescribed ADD Adderall tend to hand it out to their classmates so they can study late into the night. And those people who have normal dopamine levels, when you take it above normal, it becomes an addicting substance. So again, it's a tricky balance, but you know, the point is that the risks, you know, and benefits, the benefits outweigh the risk in kids that really do have ADD in this period. They're not going to learn unless they're focused. And this is an incredibly important period of life to be learning some basic and less than basic, very complicated skills. So if they are on the drug to manage their learning, that's a good thing, but short periods as necessary.
Let me just read a final comment here. Lauren writes, I'm struck by how close this surge in brain development seems to be to toddlerhood. I work with 18 to 24-month-old children while my husband is a high school teacher, and we're often dealing with the same things during our workday. I suspect the biggest difference is that we are socially hardwired to view babies with love and affection, while teenagers trigger a very different set of reactions and expectations from adults. And maybe those adults, too. One thinks about perhaps the president in this toddlerhood brain development category. Let me thank you for joining us, Frances Jensen. Good to have you with us. And she'll be at City Arts and Lectures this evening at 7:30. Her book, again, is The Teenage Brain, A Neuroscientist's Survival Guide to Raising Adolescents and Young Adults. Thank you for being a part of the program. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.